Welcome to Inside the Guard, the show that takes an in-depth look at the biggest fights from a weekend of MMA. I am your host, TP Grant. Thank you for watching on YouTube, listening, or watching on Bloody Elbow, however it is that you join me in this podcast. So, UFC 185 is in the books, and it was a bad night to be a defending UFC champion in Dallas, Texas. The rulers of the two deepest weight classes in their respective sports were deposed in a violent and decisive fashion. UFC lightweight king Anthony Pettis was handed five rounds of utter beatdown by the now lightweight champion Rafael Dos Anjos, and Joanna Jędrzejczyk dispatched women's strawweight champion Carla Esparza in the final seconds of the second round in a fight that was just brutally violent. And just a phenomenal, phenomenal performance from Jędrzejczyk. And now to talk about those incredibly brutal fights, I'm bringing in Bloody Elbow striking analyst, host of Heavy Hands, Mr. Connor Rebush. Connor, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So you spent the night covering boxing, correct? And now you're all caught up on the fights last night. You avoided Twitter and Bloody Elbow like the plague.
Somehow, I'm still riding that fight night high. I just got caught the fights probably about 2 hours ago, 2 or 3 hours ago, and the only one that was spoiled for me results wise was while tweeting from the Bad Left Hook account about Kovalev Pascal. I accidentally saw the result of Jędrzejczyk Esparza, but didn't really ruin the enjoyment of the fight for me. It was still just an absolutely stellar performance from her. But I definitely just experienced the shock of Dos Anjos upsetting Pettis as thoroughly as he did.
So you did quite a bit of work coming into this fight talking about how someone would go about beating Pettis. And on Heavy Hands with Patrick Wyman, which is an absolutely phenomenal podcast, anyone listening, you should listen to that podcast.
Normally I have to plug the show. I like this.
Hey, you came on my show, so I should help you out, right?
Yeah, thank you.
You guys deal a lot with the idea of, or are starting to deal with the idea of fighter archetypes, and kind of like categorizing how people go about approaching fighting, and that we had like a real style clash here. And Rafael Dos Anjos, who was a pressure fighter, a guy who likes to kind of push forward and get into kind of a comfortable range for him to throw, which I think we'd kind of classify as like a mid range.
Definitely.
And then Anthony Pettis, who's much more of an outside fighter, who likes to fight more at something akin to like a kicking range.
Yeah.
And so you guys mentioned that pressure fighters normally have the advantage against outside fighters, but you know, like just like everyone else, we all thought that Anthony Pettis was going to win this fight coming in. So what did Dos Anjos do to be so damn effective?
Well, In talking about the style archetypes, Pat and I have tried to focus a lot on the mentality that causes fighters to sort of display the facets of their given style. So not just, you know, where does an outfighter like to fight, but why does he like to fight there? And the reason that pressure fighters, when they pressure well, and there are not as – there honestly, people tend to think of pressure fighters as – ugly brawlers, bruisers, you know, guys who will be happy to take a shot. But history's best pressure fighters have been relatively defensively sound. Julio Cesar Chavez, for example, was never easy to hit. And when you did hit him, it wasn't easy to hit him clean. And when you did hit him clean, he'd hit you right back. And so that's really part of the mentality, is like this impatience to just get in there and make things happen and hold on to the initiative. And the reason why that's tough for an outfighter like Pettis is because Pettis, and most outfighters, he likes to have the initiative too. He's a very good adaptive fighter. We saw that against Gilbert Melendez, who tried a similar kind of pressuring approach with lesser results. And that's because by the end of the first round in that fight, Pettis had regained the initiative. Even with Melendez coming forward, he was getting Melendez to come forward in the way he wanted, and he was able to counter him. And outfighters like that. They don't like to be on equal ground, and definitely not on lesser ground than their opponent. They don't like their opponent to have any advantage, which is why Pettis always likes to be on the outside. He likes to be moving around. He likes to be feinting and making you react. He's a really good fighter when he gets to think about what he wants to do, but not when he has to think. And Dos Anjos did a really good job of forcing him to constantly think about what was going to be coming his way next, which is normally what Pettis from the outside does to his opponent. So it was like a complete inversion of his normal successful fight experience.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that Dos Anjos, I mean, obviously, Dos Anjos kind of set up his range really early in the fight.
Yeah.
And went to work. I mean, he established kind of his presence in the fight immediately with Pettis. And, I mean, I actually thought the first round was a lot closer than people made it out to be. Pettis actually returned fire with some fairly heavy artillery at points, and there was a brief moment in, like, the second half of that round when Pettis actually, I felt like, established his range, where he actually got his back off the fence and actually was standing more on that kind of black line inside the octagon. But Dos Anjos really kind of, he established his presence, and then as the fight went on, and as he got, as you said, Pettis thinking about all the things that he was doing effectively, that's when the wrestling started coming in.
Yes.
And then those level changes and taking Pettis down just totally, I felt like that was the thing that really completely threw Pettis off, where then he was already trying to work through all these variables that Dos Anjos was throwing at him, and then when the takedown started coming and started coming successfully, it was just one variable too many for Pettis to account for at that point.
I absolutely agree. And I wish I'd accounted for the wrestling aspect of this fight a little more. I just kind of, in my gaps in the armor piece, where I kind of tried to break down the flaws in Pettis' game that Dos Anjos specifically might be able to exploit, I kind of took it as a given that Dos Anjos would try to grapple him given the opportunity. Obviously, he'd be happy to be on the ground. He went for a leisurely swim in the guard of Donald Cerrone, so I kind of figured he wouldn't really have any fear of the guard game of Pettis, as fearsome as it usually is. But, you know, I won't pretend to know a lot about the mechanical specifics of wrestling and jiu-jitsu, but I do wish I touched on a little bit the importance of the takedowns, because I absolutely agree. I think he'd already basically convinced Pettis that he was not at the advantage on the feet, and then decided to take him down. And not only the threat of the takedown, meaning Pettis couldn't continue to get back into his rhythm, but then he was on the ground and getting beaten, having his guard passed, all these things that he's just not used to. It was just a thorough mental dismantling. It was impressive stuff.
Yeah, and I think we're going to, when we get to the co-main event here, we can have an in-depth talk about how hard it is to be effective at takedowns when your striking isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
When you have your striking going the way Dos Anjos does, those takedowns suddenly become a lot easier. Because as we said earlier, just it's too many variables for a fighter to account for. When you're getting hit and hit hard, and you're getting hurt, and then all of a sudden you have to think about, well, is he coming upstairs on me with a punch? Is he going to my body? Is he going to go up beside my head with a shin? Or is he going to shoot in on my legs? It's just too many things to kind of process at once.
Definitely.
And it was really amazing to see. And on the ground, I know this isn't necessarily played into you, but I'm actually, you and Pat have inspired me to kind of like delve into the idea of grappling archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
in MMA to kind of like pair with what you guys are doing. I think I've talked to you about this. I think I've talked more to Pat about it. But Pettis is what I would classify in kind of my very tenuous categories as a sprint grappler. He works best when he can operate in short stints on the ground, and even then, it's best, like, it's transitionary grappling that he really excels at. It's kind of that wide open, creating a scramble and having, like, a plan for the scramble sort of thing. I mean, once it hit the ground, it was much more the meticulous step-by-step kind of grappling that Pettis is just not really, he doesn't have, like, the deep background in grappling to, like, really contend with a guy like Dos Anjos, who originally came from a Brazilian jiu-jitsu background. Like, that is, at his core, his wheelhouse.
It was originally all he had, and he was surprisingly successful in MMA with just his grappling, which is, you know, it says a lot in this modern era of MMA when you can be competitive with top fighters at lightweight, with just a Brazilian jiu-jitsu game. I mean, he's an absolute ace on the ground. And do you think that kind of lines up with the idea of Pettis as an outfighter that, you know, as you said, he likes to force those scrambles and he likes to plan. Like, he likes to have you reacting to him. He likes to be kind of leading the dance on the ground, as it were, and basically, you know, like, when, for example, when Pettis is on the feet, He comes forward. He hits you with the left hand. Now he's got you worried about it. He knows that the next time you see the left hand coming, you're going to have to react to it, and that's when he sets up the left kick to the head of the body. Just a really simple example. But he basically sets the stage so that he knows how you will react. It's kind of similar to counterfighting, except without giving the opponent a chance to hit you. You're constantly making them react to you. And on the ground, he does the same thing with his guard, right? He did it to Ben Henderson. He was looking to do it to Dos Anjos when Dos Anjos first got him down and then realized he couldn't armbar him as easily as he can most people. He likes to have you kind of worrying about one thing, so you just walk yourself into the next attack.
I think in the case of Pettis, it does. I'm not sure it'll... As I'm kind of getting into this, I'm not sure it'll always line up, because I think of guys... like I think you guys talked about how Anderson Silva kind of also fits that category of, like, outfighter slash counterfighter. He kind of inhabits both sides. But, like, his grappling game is much slower and more meticulous and much more positionally minded. So, in the case of Pettis, I think it's a function of his athleticism, that he's such an explosive athlete that that's the kind of game that suits him best. And it also is a game that's very well suited. It's very cutting edge metagame sort of grappling for the modern MMA striker to kind of have this like sprint grappling game in the place of kind of like Anderson Silva. Anderson Silva also obviously had a great career, but I mean, what everyone always said about him, especially after the first Chael Sonnen fight, is that if you could hold him down for five rounds, you'd beat him, you know? And that's not really the case with Anthony Pettis. I mean, he had the Clay Guida hiccup, but I mean, this wasn't Rafael Dos Anjos holding Anthony Pettis down. This was Rafael Dos Anjos beating the crap out of Anthony Pettis in every phase of the fight.
And he was trying to submit him at the end of the fight. He landed heavy, heavy shots, I think, at the end of the second when he had Pettis stacked up in guard. I absolutely agree. I think you can probably try to trace those mental threads as best you can. Obviously, this is all armchair analysis. We don't know these guys personally. We're not their coaches or their parents or their close friends, but you can probably trace the idea, or the mentality behind their game, but I don't think that there's necessarily a direct correlation to how you grapple and how you strike, in terms of, you know, the tools you prefer. And I think that, you know, with Pettis, as you said, if you're going to play guard, you got to play guard like that. It's worked for Donald Cerrone, and it's worked for Carlos Condit. These guys have all been successful off their back at very high levels for a long time. Then again, Donald Cerrone has now come into his peak as a fighter, and I would say that the one thing that's really improved is his counter-wrestling, because it's very difficult to get Cerrone to the ground these days. And often he's the one shooting the takedowns, so maybe there's a bit of a warning there for Pettis if he wants to continue playing this kind of take-me-down-if-you-want game against fighters who are willing and able to do everything.
Yeah, I think you point out the idea of, like, all these guys who kind of, like, Condit and Cerrone, and a big part of it is that if you get taken down, you want to have the tools to convince the guy that that's not really the path to victory for them. Yeah, the Miles Jury fight, when Cerrone immediately threw up a omoplata and very nearly finished it and forced Jury to kind of scramble out, I mean, you didn't see Jury for shooting for takedowns after that. Mm-hmm. And once you establish that you have a fairly dangerous guard and a fairly dangerous bottom game, guys are just going to think twice about taking you down. And that, again, kind of feeds into that style. Like, how many guys the only guys we really see actively trying to take Anthony Pettis down are the guys who feel really confident in their ground games.
Yeah.
It was a Gilbert Melendez, and Gilbert Melendez paid the price for it. And that sends kind of a big message to anyone who wants to fight Anthony Pettis coming up. And obviously, Rafael Dos Anjos, I mean, has kind of demonstrated, I think in the Nate Diaz fight, demonstrated that he gives zero Fs about your guard game. and the guys he trains with, it's not surprising. Because he's
got a mean streak, too. I think he likes to tear people's guards apart. I think he enjoyed that part of the Donald Cerrone fight almost as much as he enjoyed knocking Cerrone down.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when Nate Diaz, like, slapped him from inside the guard, and the immediately Dos Anjos popped up to his feet, stood in Diaz's guard and just started open hand slapping Diaz back. Like that's who Dos Anjos is when he gets in the cage. He's the guy who's going to beat you at everything, and he's going to beat you at what you do.
That was that's one of the things that I kind of keyed in on for this fight. The example that really stood out to me, I should have thought of the Nate Diaz one because it's way funnier than the one that came to my mind. But when he fought Ben Henderson, Dos Anjos, You know, they were exchanging strikes for a while, but Dos Anjos will always force an exchange. It's very difficult to hit him without him making you regret having hit him. So when Ben Henderson landed that right uppercut to the body that he likes to throw so much, that lead right to the spleen, Dos Anjos waited a beat and then immediately hit him with the same punch plus a hard left leg kick behind it. And that's something he does really well, is he will often try to embarrass you by hitting you with the... He'll hit you right back no matter what you do. That was a really important part of this fight. Pettis never got confident in his counter game, which is unorthodox and risky, but pretty effective, as we saw against Melendez. And he never got comfortable because every time he hit Dos Anjos hit him right back, whether he was successful or not. And often, he would hit Pettis with the same strike that Pettis tried to use to hit him with. Like, don't try that strike. I know how to do it better than you. It's this very strong mental message that you just can't get away with anything against me. You don't get any free punches, which, again, leads into that idea of Pettis just constantly having to think through everything. He wants to have a plan, but those plans don't work under pressure. You've got to be just reacting when you know when you're on the back foot, when the other person has the initiative. You have to be reacting in an attempt to get the initiative back on your side. You can't just be desperately trying to plan while the guy's standing there in front of you popping you with shots, you know, landing clean punches, kicks, scoring takedowns. You've got to be proactive, and Pettis was just not able to be proactive pretty soon into this fight.
Yeah, and I think with Pettis, when we're looking at him, if we're going to talk more about what's going on with him, I think Pettis's inactivity is... I'm not shocked. Okay, so I should say this. Number one, I picked Pettis going into this, just like everyone else, but of all the champions, pretty much he and Cain Velasquez are the two guys who I am not going to be shocked at some point Cain Velasquez gets in the cage and is just not the same guy anymore. And I'm kind of, and it's not shocking to me that Anthony Pettis just seemingly had this terrible performance when we're talking about a guy. Just comparing him and Rafael Dos Anjos, since 2011, or since the end of 2011, so 2012 on, Anthony Pettis has fought five times. Rafael Dos Anjos has fought five times since last April. Mm-hmm. Like, it's this and the number of injuries that Pettis is having, in addition to the fact that I think you pointed this out, that that Pettis is actually fairly hittable. Like, he's not this most defensively sound guy out there. And I think all that kind of caught up to him in this fight, maybe not in the sense of wear and tear, though it's entirely possible that he's kind of coming up on losing a step because of all the knee injuries he's suffered. But the idea that, like, you can't be this peak explosive fighter forever, and it's going to get even shorter if you're not fighting constantly because you're hurt and you're getting hit a lot when you're in there.
I think it may have something to do with it. It's definitely causing Pettis... I mean, you could definitely argue that the metagame of MMA may be passing him by somewhat, because he fought Ben Henderson, somebody he's already fought before, and had a pretty easy night of it. And then he fought Gilbert Melendez, a guy who I really think is past his prime and also has an old-school style of MMA. Then he fights a guy who is really the first all-round, three-dimensional, dangerous fighter, the guy who is offensively potent in every phase of the fight, the first guy he's fought of that type in quite some time. And given the time between those fights and everything, he obviously had difficulty adapting. But I also think that there was just... this was just kind of the path for victory for Dos Anjos. I almost think that without shoring up some serious technical deficiencies in his game, or going in there and sparring against some guys specifically designed to test his mental fortitude in those situations, Pettis would always lose this fight. And I just think, you know, let's give a small example. Pettis's footwork just falls to pieces when he's really, really pressured and forced against the cage. And it's been doing that for years. And even if he's been improving his boxing, which he has, all of that is still reliant on him being comfortable. He boxes and kicks and moves, sets things up really well when he's comfortable. But once you put him somewhere that his mentality doesn't like, once you put him somewhere where he's pressed up against the cage, he's being forced to react to you, and you're throwing a varied attack at him, he squares his feet, he throws weird arm punches, he ducks his head, does all kinds of things that you would really not expect from a guy who is a pound-for-pound great, who's been knocking off top lightweights, you know, if not at a rapid clip, been doing so pretty consistently, and with consistent ease, too. It's been a while since Pettis has struggled with anyone. So I just think Dos Anjos had something of a favorable style matchup. I think he took full advantage of it. He and Rafael Cordero just had the perfect strategy for this fight and executed it to perfection. And it must have been nice for Rafael Cordero to only have to come up with one game plan for both Benil Dariush and Rafael Dos Anjos, right? Basically, same strategy for both of his fighters against similar opponents.
Yep, I mean, it was a terrible night for UFC champions. It was a terrible night for people with the last name of Pettis. But very good
with Taekwondo backgrounds.
Yeah, very, very good night for Rafael Cordero and his students. I mean, kind of the forgotten, like, great striking coach in MMA to a certain extent. I think he, obviously because of Pat, you know, we both know Pat who trains with a Rafael Cordero school, but so we hear about him a lot. But, I mean, you don't hear a lot of other MMA, like, pundits talking about Rafael Cordero. It's like one of the great striking coaches out there.
Yeah, no, and he deserves credit. And it's not just one of the best things you can possibly say about Cordero is that he has improved and evolved as a trainer. This is the guy who was the head striking coach at Shootbox way, way back at the dawn of modern MMA as we know it. I mean, he's been coaching mixed martial artists since, what, 1999, something like that?
Yep.
And
I put this out on Twitter during the fight, but his involvement in MMA predates the UFC.
Yeah, Rafael Cordero is almost older than the sport itself, at least as far as we know it. Obviously, Vale Tudo and Shudo have been around for a while, but he's older than modern MMA, you could say that. And the thing is he's a different coach than he was then. He's a better coach, and he's one that is perfectly suited to the sport as it is right now. And not a lot of coaches can say that. Most coaches, like fighters, they get passed by eventually. But if you watch Fabricio Werdum and Benil Dariush and Rafael Dos Anjos and even the new version of Lyoto Machida, they don't look anything like the older generation of shoot-to-box fighters. They don't look like old-school Anderson Silva. They don't look like Wanderlei Silva or Shogun Hua or Ninja Hua. They are well-rounded. They are, you know, he's almost like got the perfect version of the team takedown recruitment strategy where he just takes jiu-jitsu aces and turns them into murderous kickboxers. And he does it brilliantly. He produces all of these calculated but aggressive fighters who just flatten people and do so consistently. And that's not a type of fighter he was producing early in his career. So the fact that he's adapted to the sport, and to do that, it takes humility. It takes a real, you have to almost kind of admit that you were wrong at one point and that you want to improve and get better. And the fact that, I mean, I don't, how old is Cordero now? Is he?
I'm checking it right now. The scary thing is he is only a couple years older than Anderson Silva.
And you know what the thing is? He still beats up on guys in sparring. Yeah. From what I hear.
All right, you want to know what's terrifying? Is that Cordero's only 41.
Wow.
He got out of fighting really early and got into coaching really early because I believe his recorded MMA fight, according to the Sherdog Fight Finder, is in August of 1993. So his first fight predates the UFC, UFC 1. So he got out of fighting fairly early on. I think his last fight was 1999, and kind of became a full-time coach. I mean, basically what we're seeing is, I mean, this is a guy's prime as a coach. If we take other sports as a kind of a template for this, which I think in this case we can, I think kind of across sports, when you look at guys who are kind of coaching, usually, like, if they've been involved in the sport and they get out in kind of like a normal fashion, like for most coaches, they don't play quite as long as like the really excellent players because, you know, to get that dedicated to a sport and then go through coaching, I mean, it takes a good amount of time. The 40s and the 50s tend to be when guys are like at their peak coaching wise. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing that idea that he evolved as a coach. I mean, I think in a conversation with Patrick Wyman, he was telling me about how when Pride went under and Cordero realized that there was, you know, that they had to start fighting in cages, he basically pulled the team together and said, guys, we got to throw out everything we're doing and start from scratch because it's a totally different game now.
Wow. And all credit to him for stepping away from fighting and becoming a trainer because he has an absolute talent for it. And you know what the crazy thing is? I'm thinking about this now, and I think Cordero might be the only coach I know of who seems to specialize in revitalizing fighters' careers, who seems to specialize in taking already established and successful fighters and fine-tuning them and making them better versions of themselves.
Greg Jackson had that reputation for a while.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that, honestly, I think the game may be passing Jackson Winklejohn by a little bit at this point.
I would agree with that.
Right, we see young fighters go there. They don't really come out. You know, you can kind of predict what they're going to look like after going there, which I guess you can with Cordero too, but the predictable results are much more favorable.
Yeah, and it's okay, Connor. You can continue your goal like to crusade. Be murdered by John Winklejohn.
My crusade against John Winklejohn. My invitation for him to come kick my ass. I think that with Cordero, there are all kinds of in boxing, we see this a lot, where fighters will come up with their original trainer, they get a big head, they think they're too big for him, they go to other trainers. And the results at that point are usually not that great. So maybe it's the reason that fighters are going to Cordero. They're doing it before they get to the top. They're not doing it because they think they're too good for their old trainers, but they're doing it because they realize that Cordero has something more than most trainers. And I have no problem saying that as an outsider who's never met Cordero personally. I've seen the results in his fighters, and I can say with confidence that he's better than the majority of trainers in the sport, better than the vast majority. And I'm really excited to see. Honestly, I at this point, having seen how perfectly Dos Anjos executed that game plan against Pettis, even though Nurmagomedov is not a favorable style matchup for the new lightweight champion, as we saw in their last fight, I am not ready to count Dos Anjos out in a rematch, because that was just such an impressive performance. It's given me hope for Cordero's most promising new student that maybe he'll be able to turn the tables on the Dagestani next time around.
When it comes to Nurmagomedov, I really kind of hope that he gets a fight to kind of like ramp him back in, having been out for, you know.
He's getting Cerrone.
Yeah, he's getting. Oh, that's. Oh, God. Yep. It's so. I have this thing. I never know. I like never remember the fight unless it is happening like tomorrow.
Oh, that's the life of a fight journalist, of a sports writer, right? I'm so caught up in the minutia of fights that I am shocked when a big fight is happening in at the end of the next week. I don't know until it's the start of the week and I have to start planning my articles.
Yeah. So like I said, he's fighting Cerrone. And
we'll cut that part out.
Yeah, we'll take care of it in post. So I think that's an excellent move by the UFC to kind of get him back in the swing of things. And I think Nurmagomedov, he poses big problems for anyone in that division. Just a different beast wrestling wise. Just because, I mean, there's a lot of talk about the idea of like, you know, oh, that the American scholastic wrestling style is so perfectly like attuned for MMA with its emphasis on mat work and riding time and keeping guys controlled and things like that. But there's something to be said for the diversity of takedowns and the like the real depth of technical ability that Nurmagomedov. God, I'm butchering this thing.
Nurmagomedov.
I just need it in front of me and I can say it, so I can be like Nurmagomedov. And what he brings into the cage in terms of just like he has a takedown and a throw for like every situation, which you can't always say about American wrestlers. I think that's going to be a really excellent fight. And we've spent a lot of time on the lightweights. I think there's another really violent fight that needs talking about, and that was Joanna Jędrzejczyk just beating the snot out of Carla Esparza. And I have my own thing on this real quick, because coming into this fight, I thought Esparza was going to win, mostly because I thought that having watched Jędrzejczyk's fights, she's not really good at cage wrestling. She's really excellent at wrestling out in the middle of the octagon. But if you put her against the cage, she seemed kind of lost at times. Claudia Gadelha got almost all of her takedowns based off of cage wrestling and not actual like middle of the cage shot wrestling. And for me, I made that pick, and then watching that fight, number one, Esparza didn't have any striking to establish to get Jędrzejczyk moving backwards and get her against the fence. The one takedown that Esparza got came off of cage wrestling. And for the rest of that fight, Jędrzejczyk was able to be the one pressuring Esparza and get her up against the fence and use the fence as kind of a barrier and then just unload on her. And anytime Esparza shot, it was out in the open, and Jiříček was able to sprawl.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just, at no point did Jiříček allow herself to be backed up or put against the cage. And it was just it clicked for me partway through, number one, the fact that the interplay between striking and wrestling, and the fact that I completely misread Esparza's takedown game. She is a completely shot-dependent takedown artist, and that's not going to work on Jiříček.
Well, she's normally a very good finisher. I thought Esparza was... I was gunning for Jiříček because I really like her style. And my expectation is that she would lose to the more veteran mixed martial artist in Esparza, and that maybe in a year she would have a chance to beat her. And I could not have predicted how quickly she has improved as a wrestler, because I think even given how good her takedown defense was before, even, you know, in the open space, it was better tonight. It was more developed and was more punishing. And I'll get to that in a moment, but Esparza is normally really good at finishing those takedowns. And I think a big part of why she stopped being able to to take her angles and to drive through the hips and to knock you over the table of her leg and to just drag Jiříček to the mat is that Jiříček, you mentioned this earlier. I wish I could remember when you mentioned it, because it immediately sparked a thought in my head then. But you kind of mentioned the idea of, oh, we were talking about Dos Anjos answering Pettis' kicks and making him pay for his attacks. And that's exactly what Jiříček did with her clinch game. Actually, you know what we were talking about? Was Cerrone hitting the omoplata on Miles Jury and the guard being a deterrent to the takedown? Jiříček did the same thing, but took it one step further. And instead of having to be taken down and then be really aggressive off her back, she used her strengths and made the punishment for the takedown attempt happen in the clinch. So every time that she stopped an Esparza takedown, she would get to an angle, she'd get an underhook or an overhook with that hand. She likes to do the overhook and then move to the side of the overhook, kind of like crush down on your shoulder and spin you around with that hard whizzer, which is it's great. You don't even see a lot of good wrestlers doing that. They seem really underhook dependent. So I like to see that. And then she'll crossface, or she'll get a tie clinch, and every time she did that, she'd move to the side, and then she would use that grappling angle as a striking angle. She would hit Esparza with an elbow and then break. And so every time that Esparza got in a takedown, it became less and less favorable for her to even keep trying, which ultimately led to Esparza dancing around on the outside, not knowing what to do with the striking because she was so heavily outmatched, and not even feeling confident in her takedowns. I mean, the second round of that fight was Esparza barely going for takedowns. She had absolutely no answer, to the point that I kind of wished her corner would have stopped it. Though the referee did a fantastic job of giving her just enough of a chance and then calling it off when she was about to go down. So I really think a big thing about Jiříček's game is not only stuffing the takedown, but making every single attempt a painful experience. And she actually, on one of those, I think was the first time she actually rocked Esparza. She got her in a collar tie after stuffing a takedown, and then hit her with one of those Matt Brown slapping elbows.
Yeah.
Wiped her forearm across her jaw and staggered her into the fence, and at that point it was already the beginning of a long and painful end for the former champion.
Yeah, the angles that Jiříček was taking on the takedowns was something that I noticed as well, because it was just such beautifully clean wrestling, melded immediately, as you said, into striking. That Jiříček is just, she's the jump that she took from her previous fights to this fight is the kind of jump that you want to see in like a phenom MMA prospect.
Yeah,
and I was with you. I'm like, I said that she's probably a year away from being the best version of the fighter that she's going to be, and if this is her a year away, that's terrifying for the rest of that 115-pound division.
Right. The way that she, I mean, it's almost like she does it like Jose Aldo, which is fantastic, because I've been saying for a long time that Aldo has the best approach to sprawl and brawl. He's a technical sprawl and brawler. Brawling obviously doesn't do what he or Jiříček do justice. It doesn't. It's not a good description, but
what?
That's the phrase we're stuck with.
You mean like a little? You mean like a little rhyming phrase that people came up with back in like 2003? Doesn't get into the minutia of MMA fighting?
I'll come up with a new one. Stuff and scuff. Is that... I don't really get the point across. But
we'll keep that one as a backup.
Okay.
And you keep talking.
But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, Aldo has for a long time been using boxing footwork to kill takedowns. Because when you get right down to it, the footwork that makes wrestling, not just footwork, but the positioning in general, that makes wrestling work also makes striking work. They are one and the same. And so, you know, if I get underneath you and hit you with a punch, I have a better chance of hurting you because I've got the leverage. I'm going to hit you from underneath and knock you on your ass. And if I move to the side, not only can you not take me down, but you can't hit me effectively. And I can hit you. And since I'm at an angle, I can either take you down more easily because you're not facing me to stop the takedown, or I can knock you down more easily for the same reason. Your balance isn't there to help you absorb the strike. So, I mean, all of these angles and positions, whether it's level changes or side-to-side angles, they play both ways. And so I loved seeing Jan Jacek do what she already does well, which is take angles, move to the side. She's always been very good at pivoting away from punches and apply that just with very little adjustment, you know, with the addition of an overhook, apply that to wrestling exchanges. And it allowed her to not only like stop Esparza's takedowns, but she was out wrestling Esparza. I mean, she was beating her in wrestling situations and then adding in strikes to just make it all the more uncomfortable for the woman she was fighting. So just the way that it's just a perfect marriage of striking and grappling in a way that they actually are inseparable rather than even being two sides of the same coin. It's just fighting, and Jan Jacek, she gets it. She gets how all of the pieces fit together.
You know who I think of when you talk about that is Anderson Silva. When his takedown defense kind of hit that next level, it wasn't because he was working on his wrestling. It wasn't because he was working on his clinch. It was because he worked on his footwork. And he became so good at, like, hitting those angles that guys just couldn't shoot on him. He went through a streak where we rarely ever saw him get taken down. Or early in his career, it was not rare at all for Anderson Silva to be playing his guard.
Absolutely. And it's a preventative matter. I mean, if I'm not there to be taken down, how are you going to take me down? And even if you try, it's not going to be a very good takedown attempt, and I'm going to have an easy job stuffing it from that point on. And that's, you know, Jan Jacek's had a long career as a striker. So whoever taught her to wrestle clearly taught her well. It allowed her to pick it up very quickly because they were like, hey, remember all that stuff you've been doing really well for a long time? Do it with your hands on the person, and you'll out-wrestle them. It's the same thing. And, boy, did she put an ass-whooping on Carla Esparza. She pieced her up.
Yeah. All right. So I think I have one more thing if you want to talk about before you have to go. Well, it's kind of two fights, but we'll do them quick. It is way, way down on the card, early fight. First of all, Joe Duffy looked absolutely phenomenal in his debut. Did you get a chance to see this one?
Yeah, he ran roughshod over poor Jake Lindsay.
So if you had to come up with like some quick thoughts on Joe Duffy's performance, what would they be in terms of like what was he doing that made him so freaking effective?
Well, he had a little trouble with Jake Lindsay's leg kicks early, but I think he mitigated that by, just like the fighters we just talked about way up on the other end of the card, he refused to let those kicks go unpunished. So he was making sure that even when he was being hit, he was answering, which is something that, you know, that you can fight like a sportsman or you can fight like a fighter. And to be really successful, you have to have that instinct, or you have to learn at some point how to fight back. And that's what he was doing really well. But in terms of technique, I mean, he was putting his punches together beautifully. And it was some of the best combination punching in a debut, probably since Conor McGregor made his debut. And just one example is sticking out in my mind right now. When Lindsay came in, I think they exchanged right hands. Both guys missed. And then Lindsay started moving away. And Duffy just followed up his right hand with a left cross or kind of a long left hook, caught Lindsay on the way out. And staggered him a little bit. And the fact that he is putting these punches together, it makes it so much harder to exchange with him on the feet because, you know, one punch might miss, but the next punch is going to land as a result of the first punch making you move a certain way. And that's what good combination punching is really about. Each, in the same way a grappling scramble is, you're allowing an escape to one side so that they end up turning themselves into the choke or whatever, on the feet, you are throwing a punch to get them to move into the path of the next punch. Even if you're fully committing to your punches, that's how a good combination works. And Duffy, I mean, he fully committed to punches without ever throwing himself off balance, always being in position to follow up with the next one. And it was frequently the third or even the fourth punch that connected when he was trading with Lindsay, which I found to be very impressive.
Awesome. So next thing, we got to go to the other half of the Pettis brother equation. Sergio Pettis looked really good in the octagon for 99% of his fight. And I'm usually not one. I usually find people who decry fighters' chins like as the first thing they go to usually be incorrect. There's usually other factors in play. Sergio Pettis, to me, is one of the clearest examples of a fighter having a chin problem since Alistair Overeem, who also kind of got to debut the idea that it is really hard when your body kind of betrays you in that sense and forces you to have to fight perfect every time you go out there.
Yeah, I don't really have a problem with saying that Pettis, just like Overeem, has a chin problem, as you put it. I think that's pretty apt. But I also think that both of those are examples of guys who aren't comfortable with their defensive skills or just don't have many defensive skills. Like when we said this about Anthony Pettis, boy, we got torn apart, Pat and I, on our episode of Heavy Hands. Someone on YouTube was not happy about our assessment that Anthony Pettis is not a very good defensive fighter. But I think you can pretty clearly look at Duke Rufus's fighters, Koch, both Pettis brothers, and say that they don't have good striking defense. They just don't. They stand stock still with their head right up in the air. They don't move. They don't really block punches well. They parry. That's really like their go-to, because I think Rufus has it in his head that if you slip punches or roll under them or lean back or whatever, you're going to eat a kick. And that's not really the best way to go about these things. If you put it, because, you know, if you parry a punch, you can eat a punch too. You know, if you fall into this idea of thinking that there's one perfect method of defense that fits all problems and solves all punches or kicks coming your way, then you limit yourself to that and you become predictable. And Joe Rogan and Mike Goldberg weren't doing a great job calling the Pettis fight, because even though Pettis was landing the better strikes and using his length and his combination, and he's a very skilled offensive striker, he was using those things very well against Benoit. Benoit was also hitting him a lot. He was, you know, he was getting tagged every single time, usually on the counter, but he was landing his hands on Sergio, and Sergio was responding very well, often hitting him with two punches for every one that Benoit landed. Benoit doing a bad job of kind of sticking around and taking a picture, as they say, after landing his shots, but he was landing his shots. And so it was kind of a matter of time before one of them went down. It seemed more likely that Benoit would go down, but there's only so long that you can stand in there with a guy, not put him away, and be hit every time he throws at you before something is going to hit you hard enough to hurt. And Benoit definitely threw the better left hook in that exchange of lefts, and Pettis paid the price for it.
Yeah, it was, like I said, it kind of goes to the idea, it's very difficult to fight when you have to fight perfect. And I don't think I think most of Duke Rufus's fighters have, in addition to the parrying, they have nice movement, and Pettis was...
Movement absolutely is like their go-to. They want to be away, but when they're being stuck in close range, they don't really have answers.
Yeah, because Sergio was hitting a nice little angle when Benoit would come forward and would land his cross pretty nicely, but it's that second layer of defense that's missing. Yeah. It's once you can't move anymore, or once the guy's adjusted for your movement, what's the next thing that stops you from getting punched in the face?
And I think that's what puts the stress on this idea of having to fight the perfect fight, because if you only have one way that you think is the perfect way to defend, you know, it's almost putting this idea in your head that once you get hit or once they take that away from you, it's over. And maybe that's the reason we've seen some mental lapses from Sergio Pettis in the past, or from Alistair Overeem. They have this idea that once they can't do the one thing they think is the way to fight, that it just all falls apart. You kind of, you feel like you have no recourse. And if you want to be a prepared fighter, you don't set plans in motion and expect things to go a certain way, but you have to plan for when things don't go your way. You have to have a second and a third and a fourth layer of defense, and when your defense fails you, you got to be able to brawl with the guy and hit him hard enough to convince him not to come at you. You've got to have these inbuilt contingency plans, and neither Anthony nor Sergio really has that.
Oh, no. Well, we just lost Connor, it looks like.
Oh, still here?
Yeah, you dropped. You dropped a little bit. So
sorry about that. Anthony brawls when he gets caught in trouble, which is great. He fights. It's not his natural style, but he'll fight against type for a bit to convince you it's not a good idea. But then what happened when Rafael dos Anjos kept coming and out-brawled him? Pettis was out of ideas. And for Sergio, he doesn't even have that brawler's instinct. He will hit you with these beautiful counter shots, move around, take these nice angles, set things up. But what happens when he can't move out of the way? What happens when he's caught in an exchange? He tends to get hit, and pretty easily, because he just doesn't have a second layer. And I don't know. It's you can only do that for so long. Look at what's happening to Eric Koch now, you know? Yeah. Koch was once a top lightweight in the world, knocking everybody out. Now he's basically getting lit up in every fight. And once people start to key in on that, once there's enough footage out there, film is the bane of the limited fighter. You have to be able to adapt on the fly.
And when you get guys who kind of address like a problem like this, like a Rafael dos Anjos who took heavy shots, it's that adding of another layer of defense.
Yeah, absolutely. And dos Anjos had multiple ways to respond to Pettis' threats. In that fight, he would step back at times. Times he would cover up. Times he would block. At times he would parry. At times he would move his head, usually throwing a simultaneous punch. He was reacting in many, many different ways, and that allowed him to not have to react all the time. You know, because Pettis never was able to key in on how he was going to react, so Pettis never got the chance to do what he does so well. Never got the chance to seize that initiative, and lead the fight. And Pettis himself, he had his same limited array of responses. As dynamic as he seems, when it comes right down to it, there are some very clear limitations to the way that he fights, and unless he addresses those things, both in the mental and the skill side, he's, the blueprint might be out there for how to beat Anthony Pettis. I don't think this was, and Sergio too, you know, I don't think either of these fights was an example of a crazy out of nowhere, you know, lucky shot or anything like that, or bad night. I think it was two guys being beaten in very, very risky style matchups. And that's just kind of what happens. You got to prepare for those other styles. You have to be able to change it up.
All right. Well, I think we've just about covered it. And as usual, whenever I bring someone on, especially you, Connor, because we just kind of go, it goes way over the time I allotted for. We pretty much talked about everything I wanted to talk about, so I'm just going to call the show here.
Good.
People listening, you can find Connor at BoxingBush on Twitter. You can also find him at BloodyElbow.com. Also, this comes out on Tuesday on Bloody Elbow, so after you get done listening to this on Tuesday, look for Heavy Hands to come out on Bloody Elbow now.
On Wednesday.
So you can get all your fight info that you need right now. Anything else coming out, Connor? What's coming out article-wise?
Well, I am currently working on probably what will be a monster of a two-part breakdown of Rafael dos Anjos' victory, and I've got to talk about Jan Jacek, and pretty soon now I'm going to start putting out several Mayweather-Pacquiao technique breakdowns, since we got that fight coming up on May 2nd, so lots of things planned, but like we said earlier, the immediate future is it's very difficult to see anything but what's immediately ahead, so.
What was that boxing fight you mentioned?
Pacquiao versus Mayweather.
I don't know those guys. Yeah, and exciting news from the prospect front. Zane and I have finally finished scouting middleweight. So, Bloody Elbow Scouting Report coming out soon. And, as always, on Friday, you can catch me on the MMA Prospectus with Zane Simon and Patrick Wyman. We will be talking about this card and the younger fighters, and we'll spend a great deal of time talking about probably things like Benel Dariush and Sergio Pettis and the barn burner that was Jared Rochalt's fight. Just fantastic fun like that. Connor, thanks for joining in. Everyone listening, have a great day. Sorry, Connor, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great week.